Great. Well, welcome everybody. Hello, and thank you for joining this online webinar at the International Inequalities Institute, which is part of the seminar series on migration, ethnicity, and race. Today, you can see the title here. The talk is entitled Desperate Responsibility, Precarity, Day Labour, and Right-Wing Populism. I'm Professor Lucinda Platt from the Department of Social Policy at the LSE, and I'm going to be chairing the event today. And the speaker we have with us here is Dr. Paul Apostolidis, and he's from the Department of Government at the LSE. And he's going to be discussing his conception of precarity, drawing both on his work on Latino migrant day labourers, but also alongside his most recent development of his work on precarity in relation to the rise of populism. So Paul will talk for about 40 minutes, and then there'll be an opportunity for questions with the event lasting until 2 p.m. So, Paul, over to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me to speak to you today, and thanks to all who are here. Especially thanks to you, Lucinda, for coordinating this excellent seminar series, especially with all the difficulties that are posed by the current circumstances. Lucinda said, my talk today is partly based on the book that I published last year, which is called The Fight for Time, Migrant Day Laborers and the Politics of Precarity. In part, I'll also discuss a current article project that extends the book's analysis by exploring connections between precarity and right-wing populism. So the book's point of departure is that although we frequently hear that working conditions for masses of people have become far more precarious in recent times, too rarely do researchers or public commentators explore in detail what precarity means and what its political consequences are. Popular and academic writers alike are usually content to gesture toward well-known economic changes like the spread of more part-time employment, the expansion of the gig economy, and the withdrawal of social welfare protections against market forces. Precarity is typically described with general terms like uncertainty, unpredictability, and anxiety. But too often, our understanding of this vast new syndrome, which arguably defines the current era of capitalist work culture, gets no more complicated than that. So my thesis is that if we grasp on a more minute level of everyday experience what precarity is, how it feels, and how it is lived by working people, then we will know better how to organize anti-precarity politics. And I mean more specifically a politics against precarity that is also a politics of precarity in the sense of drawing its motivations and resources from within people's practical material experiences rather than simply from moral denunciations of precarity as wrong or unjust. Now, the book develops a new theory of precarity by juxtaposing migrant day laborers' commentaries about their everyday work lives with concepts drawn from recent critical theory that characterize precaritizing dynamics on the broad social level. And this leads to two key arguments in the book regarding precarity, and a third argument that I'll also discuss today. So first, precarity has a bivalent social structure. On the one hand, certain hyper-marginalized groups like day laborers are singled out for exceptionally harsh forms of precaritization, especially through the racialized global deportation regime. On the other hand, day laborers put distinctive words on experiences of precarity that suffuse the working world as a whole. And they do so in theoretically innovative and politically productive ways. Second, precaritized existence involves contradictory experiences of time in everyday work life. So for people living and working in precarity, the future isn't just frighteningly unpredictable. It's also all too predictable. The anxiety never lets up, not just because it is too uncertain whether there is enough work and income to support one's basic welfare in the future, but also because it is all too certain that ever-present pressures to find work and to work will never let up. And the precaritized subject typically embraces personal responsibility as the key to relieving such pressures through socioeconomic advancement. But in ways that I'll explain, this tends to intensify rather than resolve the temporal contradiction and further entrench the condition of precarity. Now, the article that I'm in the midst of writing argues that this syndrome inhibits precaritized subjects from engaging in the forms of temporally versatile and capacious thinking that democratic citizenship requires. And in this way, I argue precaritized working life furnishes a pedagogy in the forms of temporal citizenship that right-wing populism favors, specifically in ways characteristic of Trumpism in the United States. Such citizenship affirms a historically flat discourse that laments the growing ubiquity of precarity, but responds by resurrecting white supremacist hierarchies that blame the most precaritized groups for general social suffering. And Trumpism also mobilizes a politics of affect that is defined by the paradoxical temporality of nonstop crisis, shock events that are as randomly disruptive as they are incessant. So the upshot is that although Trump himself may be on the way out, Trumpism as a formidable hegemonic project with deep roots and strong loyalties among diverse social constituencies will likely endure and grow as long as Americans fail to build a viable anti-precarity politics. Such a politics would have to integrate general solidarity against widely encompassing transracial, transethnic precarity, with advocacy for and by those worst afflicted by precarity's advance. And it also would need to cultivate an affective milieu that gives participants lived experiences of time, work, and citizenship that offer an experiential basis for building an alternative democratic culture. Okay, so let me first discuss the analysis of precarity and time that I provide in the book. But methodologically, this project derives its framework from the intellectual tradition that has animated the day labor organizing network in the United States from its inception in the late 1980s through today. And this is the tradition of popular education, of whom the leading exponent has been the Brazilian political philosopher, Paulo Freire. The basic thrust of popular education, as Freire articulates it, is, quote, to make oppression and its causes objects of reflection by the oppressed and by others, he emphasizes, who join with the oppressed in solidarity. Freire argues that oppressed persons can and should act as full-fledged subjects in analyzing and transforming their conditions of subordination in conjunction with other people who may not share their specific circumstances of oppression, but who still are widely affected by generally encompassing dynamics of domination. And popular education centrally involves dialogical encounters. These are radically egalitarian interactions in which all participants understand their need to learn from one another and reject any hierarchy that elevates those who supposedly know above those who are considered ignorant. For Freire, academic researchers can contribute to these dialogical processes by searching for what he calls generative themes in the commentaries that subjugated people make about their everyday lives. And such exploration pivotally involves field research in local communities, like the program of interviews and participant observation that I conducted at two day labor centers in the United States. Freire defines a generative theme as a word or phrase that expresses a common situation in a striking way because it gives a vivid sense of concrete reality. It tends to have a certain poetic quality. It packs a lot of emotion and it lends itself easily to visualization. The idea is that once themes are identified through field research, they can then be used as material for popular educational dialogue sessions. And they offer generative material in the sense of encouraging people to explore the power relations behind the predicaments named by the themes and to consider ways to change things politically. So in other words, I would say that in Freire's original contribution, generative themes foster theoretical innovation from below, from those rarely recognized as critical thinkers, much less as theorists. And so my aim in the project partly was to produce generative themes that the worker centers where we did our research could use in their popular educational programming, as this slide shows from one of our sessions on occupational safety and health. But now my other ambition was to brush workers' themes up against critical theory and see what sparks might fly. The logic for pairing theme and theory in this way stems from Freire's thought, but it also takes a step beyond it. So the principle of political intellectual reciprocity imbues Freire's concept of dialogue, and it affirms that all parties to popular education, as I said, stand to learn new things from one another. And so if a theme shows the potential to communicate something distinctive about experiences and struggles that go beyond the local community that articulates the theme, then perhaps it can open up prospects for wider circles of dialogue and political action. I mean dialogues in which the themes spoken by day laborers on the extreme margins of society can help working people in the mainstream, or even in privileged positions, learn more about their own social situation, which may not be so different from that of impoverished migrant workers, as many might comfortably assume. And so, where there are resonances between day laborers' themes and concepts developed by critical theory to characterize broadly ranging dynamics of precarity, that's where I see opportunities for this kind of reciprocal political learning. Now, before discussing the themes in the workers' commentaries, let me tell you some more about my field research. So day laborers, as any don't know, are individuals who seek extremely temporary jobs by standing out on street corners or hovering around the parking lots of big box construction stores like Home Depot, or going to worker centers that operate as hiring sites. Day laborers are constantly hunting for jobs, but even so, on the average, they only get work about 2 or 3 days a week. They earn very low wages doing yard work, construction, moving jobs, and they're very poor. About half the workers whom we interviewed were homeless, and many had trouble getting enough to eat. In the United States, about 3/4 of day laborers are unauthorized migrants. About 90% are from Latin America, mostly from Central American countries and Mexico. And almost all US day laborers are men, although migrant women domestic workers are increasingly getting housekeeping jobs through day labor centers. And they have also recently assumed key leadership roles in the day labor network. Worker centers in turn belong to the expanding genre of what we would call alternative labor organizations. In the United States, these centers organize workers who are largely left out of the mainstream union movement, but who are growing rapidly in numbers with mass cross-border migration and ever more contingent employment. There are somewhat over 200 worker centers in the United States today, with about half of these being day labor centers specifically. And most worker centers combine multiple functions. So they operate hiring halls, but they also run educational programs and cultural programs. They provide access to social services and health services, and they foster political awareness and political action. In our field research, my assistants and I conducted nearly 80 semi-structured interviews with individual day laborers at the two main day labor centers in the Pacific Northwest. This was Casa Latina in Seattle and the Martin Luther King Jr. Day Labor Center in Portland, run by the VOS Workers' Rights and Education Project. And then we supplemented these interviews with about 300 hours of participant observation. Most of this involved volunteering by taking employer calls and doing job dispatch at Casa Latina and teaching English at VOS. I also provided context for these local studies by interviewing leaders of the National Day Labor Organizing Network and leaders at prominent day labor organizations in Washington, D.C., in Chicago, in New York, and Los Angeles. But it was really the worker interviews in Seattle and Portland that furnished my main source for identifying generative themes. And we discussed four main topics in these interviews. So first of all, we asked participants about their migratory travels in search of work and their experiences looking for jobs through the worker centers. Although we did not talk about workers' transborder migration because the worker centers were reluctant to have us discuss those issues with the workers. Almost all the workers also had sought employment at informal hiring sites on street corners. And so we asked workers about those ventures. And we spoke to workers too about their encounters with occupational safety and health risks, which are rampant in day labor. And we discussed the workers' thoughts finally regarding the kinds of communities that they wanted to build through the worker centers. Here today, I want to focus on one major generative theme that emerged in these interviews, and that's the theme of desperate responsibility. In the interviews, the workers described what it was like to be constantly on the move, looking for jobs and shifting between jobs, but also to be frozen day after day in a kind of paralysis, waiting for the job lottery results at Casa Latina or the MLK Center, which usually were discouraging. When they talked about these experiences, the word that we heard most often was the term desperation. We asked one participant why more workers didn't come to the skills training classes when they had no luck in the job lottery. And he replied, it's that sometimes people get desperate because they aren't working, because sometimes there's work and sometimes there's not. And another worker in Portland explained how desperation felt internally, why it drained his motivation to attend the English classes even when he didn't have a job. He said, how can I put it? It's the worries. I think that if I had a job where I worked until the evening, I'd get organized enough to study. My mind doesn't rest. I'm worried thinking about it, so my head doesn't let me rest. As these comments illustrate, the workers' sense of desperation had a great deal to do with their everyday experiences of time, and these were often contradictory. So on the one hand, things were always changing for these day laborers in unpredictable ways. Time flows in everyday life were riddled with discontinuities. Each new day labor job, as you can imagine, brought material conditions and employer demands that were different and hard to foresee, especially in terms of the pace of work. The random stop and start timing of jobs, along with the lottery's uncertainty, aggravated the feeling that these workers had that they never knew what would happen next. That's the actual lottery jar there, by the way, from Casa Latina, festooned with NFL football logos. wage theft is also a severe problem in day labor. Employers cheat workers of their wages in all sorts of ways, such as by arbitrarily changing the wage rate or switching the job to something more complicated that should be more generously compensated, or simply not paying a worker at all. And wage theft further compounded the instability of time in daily life because the workers never could be sure how much their labor time would end up being worth. Now, on the other hand, and paradoxically, time also flowed with a relentless and oppressive continuity that the workers described. They were perpetually anxious about never having enough work, never earning enough money, never knowing how long they would have a place to sleep and enough food to eat. And they were always bracing themselves to stave off such personal catastrophes by working at any job at any wage that they could get. We asked one worker what he most wanted, and he answered without a pause, just work, working wherever it may be, doesn't matter where. If you don't work, there's no money, there's no food, there's no house, there's no nothing if you don't work. And yet, despite the degree to which these day laborers felt powerless and at the mercy of fate, it was remarkable how often they also affirmed an ethic of personal responsibility. This term too resounded through the interviews. And they said that they sought to be responsible by working efficiently and productively. In other words, by striving to use their time on the job and off the job wisely. Many contrasted good workers who acted this way with bad workers who were lazy, who drank too much, who let the employers down. Like one worker who said, well, I've gone to work with people who just wanna sit there talking. If the employers tell you that it's a 6-hour job, they wanna do it in 12. These workers insisted also that it was important not only to always give it their best, echarle ganas was the Spanish phrase, but also to visibly demonstrate to the employer how strong their work ethic was. And so, as you can see, there was a kind of a jarring misfit between workers' hopeless sense that they could exercise no independent control over their lives and their stalwart embrace of personal responsibility. Exercising such responsibility implied a level of autonomy to make prudent choices that desperate circumstances, by the workers' own accounts, precluded. These competing tugs between responsibility and desperation were especially acute when workers talked about occupational safety and health hazards. And their themes in discussing these matters extended the notion of desperate responsibility, giving it a distinctly bodily dimension. They stressed that day labor unavoidably involved facing risk on all sides, but that one could tame the uncertainty by resolutely keeping eyes wide open. Again, a temporal dilemma defined this thematic pairing. So on the one hand, workers felt continuously compelled to stay vigilant for bodily threats as job types, work sites, equipment, and employers' personalities and demands perpetually shifted. But on the other hand, such changes irregularly disrupted work's time flows, as did unpredictable trauma events of bodily injury. Workers sought to mitigate this contradiction by invoking an ethic of personal responsibility. And this was premised on keeping one's eyes wide open for emergent dangers and staying committed, personally committed to the value of self-protection. Keeping safe on the job thus served as another criterion by which workers would differentiate morally between good workers and bad workers. And yet, again, there was a tension here because most workers admitted that they commonly violated their own ethical resolve because they couldn't resist employers' pressures to work dangerously and because their working conditions simply fluctuated too frequently. Now, in one sense, this composite theme of desperate responsibility points to a form of precarity that applies in an exceptional way to day laborers and to other highly marginalized migrants. Desperation is a constant for day laborers because they staff the lower rungs of the residential housing construction and related industries, which are especially prone to economic crises in the financialized neoliberal economy. And they're also uncommonly dangerous for workers, along with meatpacking, which I've also studied. It's the most dangerous industry in America. Desperation also comes, of course, from occupying the position of illegality, which constitutes the migrant subject as perpetually deportable, vulnerable to deportation, to detention, hyper-exploitable for labor, and available for the most hazardous jobs. In this position, it's easy to see why day laborers reach for the stabilizing story of personal responsibility, with its reassuring promises of control over everyday events, sustained bodily integrity, and individual progress over time. And unauthorized workers also face abundant pressure to embrace the story, that is, to show visibly and to say audibly how conscientious and how hardworking they are, in a political atmosphere where both major parties and most migrant justice organizations dichotomize between bad immigrants who are criminals and good immigrants who just want to work and support their families. And yet, the theme of desperate responsibility also signals a conundrum that workers throughout capitalist societies face today. And here, I want to underscore the book's central thesis, which is that as much as precarity aims exceptionally cruel forms of power at certain abject populations, such as day labor also serves as a synecdoche, a part that represents the whole, right, for dynamics of precarity that extend across society as a whole. Consider how the self-conflicting temporality of desperation described by day laborers, in which times oppressive continuity coexists with times bewildering discontinuity. Think about how that's a feature of daily life for legions of other workers in today's economy. Critical theorists of work have analyzed how time flows in perpetually uniform ways for those who perform immaterial labor, affective labor, and short-term labor in the service economy, even as these same processes fracture time into disconnected bits of experience. As Kathy Weeks argues, today's post-industrial work ethic commands not only that we do our jobs faithfully, but also that we demonstrate how much we love them by acting as quote unquote professionals who are always on call whenever our work is needed, whether that work is conventionally esteemed as professional or not. And yet, as the call can come at any time, work becomes both incessant and randomly interruptive. Portable digital devices amplify this paradoxical effect, as I think most of us have experienced. And as Franco Berardi observes, right, by ensuring that, quote, at every moment and place, workers are reachable and can be called back to perform a productive function that will be reinserted into the global cycle of production. And so, time's homogenization in the forms of incessant labor and ever readiness to work, mashed with time's fractalization, this also follows from the proliferation of gig jobs. And again, this is a widely encompassing social problem. It's not only happening in platform-based enterprises like Uber and Deliveroo, but it's also in software development, in law, in journalism, and as we know, in academia. Meanwhile, the embodied temporal experience by which crisis moments erratically alternate with distressed continuity spreads throughout the general population as work becomes more dangerous in similar ways for nearly everyone. There's been a lot written, obviously, during COVID-19 about the disparate fates of different kinds of workers and different exposures to occupational safety and health risk. And that's all true and vital to understand. But the longer term trends towards continuities of experience are also very important to acknowledge, right? The leading culprits in OSH matters in the economy today are escalating work environmental hazards, especially hazards that are related to poor air quality, whether that's in office buildings or in warehouses for Amazon, ergonomically dysfunctional work processes, and also the stress effects of corporate restructuring. And these permeate the employment economy today. As these tendencies unfold, workers in virtually all occupations suffer protracted etiologies of job-related bodily debilitation, marked at uneven intervals by major diagnoses. And workers also live the immediate body time in the labor process of constantly assessing the risk on all sides and bracing for impact, even as risk factors haphazardly shift and moments of physical trauma sometimes ensue. I argue that day labor's generative themes further express widespread social experiences in the way that they weld personal responsibility to these phenomena, these predicaments of desperation. Many theorists have commented on the unbearable responsibilization of subjects that's associated with post-industrial professionalism, the neoliberal culture of treating oneself as a form of human capital, and austerity-based cuts in social benefits. In occupational safety and health, leading firms have likewise offloaded their institutional liability for preventing job-related injuries and illnesses onto individuals through strategies of corporate restructuring and also the recently popularized wellness culture. In these ways as well, the composite theme of desperate responsibility, I think, names a broadly encompassing social condition of precarity, notwithstanding its peculiar intensity for unauthorized migrants and other starkly vulnerable groups. So what I'd like to focus on now are the specifically political consequences of this formation of precarity as desperate responsibility. You can sense an aura of desperation in the compulsive effort to subordinate all time to the demands of work, even as cohesive structures of time in everyday life come apart. Responding to this unresolved predicament with a pat narrative of self-advancement through personal responsibility is yet another desperate move. It's what I would call a despondent leap beyond the vexing frustrations of the present into an individualist fantasy of the future's orderly unfolding. The leap abandons the task of reflecting on why the time of everyday life is so intolerable, how social power operations have produced this syndrome, and how collective efforts could make the future turn out differently. One political cost of making this move is an impoverished ability and motivation to imagine free life activity in terms other than those that are approved by the dominant work ethic. And this is the problem that most troubles my friend and colleague, Kathy Weeks. But the precaritized subject also pays another political price for the reassurance that the leap from desperation to responsibility promises. Because precarity trains the working subject to assume a distinctly non-critical attitude towards time transits between daily struggles and horizontal possibilities. The subject thus forfeits freedom in two ways, not only by clinging to a threadbare vision of free action, but also by submitting to the disabling of the temporal critical consciousness that is needed to bring unrealized prospects into existence. This process of cultivated disability with respect to critically navigating experiences of time also impairs democratic citizenship in ways that political theorist Antonio Vázquez Arroyo's theory of political responsibility can help us to appreciate. So for Vázquez Arroyo, democratic citizenship depends on a capacity that he calls political literacy. And this involves approaching present-day situations of suffering and social dysfunction as the outcomes of struggles that may have led to defeat for the time being, but that could be re-engaged and could lead to alternative results if citizens analyze the historical sources of these defeats and then respond to them differently. And Vázquez Arroyo contrasts such political responsibility with an attitude towards such situations that would psychologize them as losses from which one simply needs to move on. My argument is that precarity configured as desperate responsibility mightily discourages such politically responsible reckoning with loss. That's another key term, political responsibility. Consider the distracting countertugs of time in the grip of everyday desperation. Think of that worker's comment, "My head doesn't let me rest." These forces make it very difficult to assume the disposition of hopeful stillness that Vázquez Arroyo sees as crucial to the temporal thought maneuvers of political literacy. This is especially so given that reevaluating the struggle is always an embodied practice, which precaritized body time as the trap of keeping eyes wide open while facing risk on all sides further hinders. Invoking responsibility then comes as a gesture of escape, of moving on rather than patiently assessing the present and its antecedents and discerning untried paths forward. This lack of political literacy also inhibits desperately responsible subjects from grappling with what I've called the socially bivalent character of precarity. As I noted before, the challenge is to build general solidarity in the face of precarity that extends across most of society, while also contesting the dynamics that single out certain groups for especially cruel precaritization. Bridget Anderson's concept of migrantizing the citizen speaks to this daunting challenge, and I think also to the temporal sensibility that it entails. So Anderson criticizes the persistence of an unreflective migrant-citizen dualism in public and academic discourses, which she says figures the migrant as the economically needy border transgressor who always potentially threatens the national citizen. This dichotomy, she contends, ignores rising mobility within nation states as well as national subjection to the same economic stresses and hardships that plague transborder migrants. And Anderson proposes the following response. She writes, "Migrantizing the citizen excavates the connections between exclusions within citizenship and exclusions from citizenship. Unearthing these homologous experiences between white and non-white, national and non-national, requires the skill and the will to spy within present afflictions the legacies of power struggles that have transpired over time. In other words, it demands capacities akin to those of political literacy, as theorized by Vasquez Arroyo. As Anderson writes, it implies making the effort to, quote, recognize differences between nationals and non-nationals, at the same time as demonstrating structural and historical links between the experiences and relations of both. And yet the desperately responsible subject's temporal confusion and exasperation stymie these exertions of critical thought. Instead, dismayed that their current experiences increasingly mirror those of migrants and other racially despised groups, these subjects may be more likely to respond defensively, resurrecting racial hierarchies and denouncing society's others for causing their own and everyone else's precaritization." And so this brings me to the final part of my talk, where I'll suggest some more specific ways that precarity and the political illiteracy that it fosters enable the advance of right-wing populism as practiced by Donald Trump and his supporters. In their recent book about precarity and populism, excellent book, Daniel Martinez, Ho Sung, and Joseph Lowndes argue that the American right has gained power in recent decades by refunctioning a historically rooted discourse that pits producers against parasites. They argue that since pre-Civil War times in America, this discourse has defined prototypical citizenship as white, masculine, and hardworking in opposition to unproductive, threatening, and feminized racial antagonists. Through the latest twist in a reiterated logic of, quote, racial transposition, Ho Sung and Lowndes contend, the contemporary right has recast as descriptors of poor whites tropes that previously were advanced to stereotype Black families and communities as pathologically dysfunctional. They point out that when Trump campaigned in 2016, even as he praised his followers as the ones who were destined to, quote, make America great again, he also called them losers all the time. They write, "Unlike the leaders of past populist revolts, Trump seemed less a champion of the working people than a figure who confirmed their debased status, reveling in such terms as disgust, weakness, losing, and pathetic." Now, how has the right managed to stir ever more strident loyalty among those whom it ridicules? Ho Sung and Lowndes offer an answer that I find partly satisfying, but that also points to the need to attend more closely to the political effects of precarity as I've analyzed them. They provide a provocative and disturbing account of what they call multiculturalist right-wing populism, in which Black, Asian, and Pacific Islander celebrities like these who are represented in pictures here, validate white male grievances, supporting Trump and reasserting the normative primacy of the traditional racial hierarchy. In the perverse but effective logic of Trumpism, this compensates for the denigration of Trump supporters as losers, not just by Trump, but also by a cadre of conservative intellectuals like Charles Murray and others. That is, right-wing multiculturalism restages a comforting national drama that affirms America as racially and ethnically diverse, but with whiteness always as the pinnacle expression of political, social, and cultural citizenship. And this then confirms the hegemony of whiteness all the more adeptly by sounding the consenting voices of the racially subaltern. Well, I think this argument makes sense, but we also need to probe beyond the sphere of discursive representation and examine material and embodied domains of subjective experience related to work to understand why the appeal of Trumpism clearly goes well beyond working class whites. So for Hosang and Lowndes, being disparaged as a loser hits home for the quote, large majority of low and middle income workers who identify as white and who no longer enjoy the insulation that whiteness has historically provided in the US against economic crisis as measured by data such as unemployment rates, household debt, and wages. This is what they mean when they talk about rising precarity, which is in the title of their book. And yet, Trumpism, as we know from public opinion surveys and now all the exit polls, resonates profoundly with well-to-do whites, as well as with growing populations of Black and Latino Americans. When we ponder Trump's trans class and interracial support, the key is not to conclude that precarity is not a strong driver of Trumpist enthusiasm. Rather, it's to see how precarity is a society-wide syndrome that encourages Trumpist citizenship among the working population at large. As I've demonstrated, precaritization is a process by which subjects are constituted in everyday working experience. And this means that precarity cannot be adequately captured by aggregate metrics like unemployment and wage rates. Central to that experience is an inducement to flee work's temporal contradictions by moving on to the stock story of economic advancement through personal responsibility. This deactivates reflection on how the misfit between traditional hierarchical distinctions and current conditions has arisen. So reinvoking white supremacist citizenship works, in other words, not just because it dovetails with Trump's rhetoric of ridicule, and not just because white working class people read the numbers and see their economic fates merging with those of society's most detested groups. The ideology resonates because precarity as lived experiences discourages America's working subjects from acquiring the political literacy needed to migrantize the citizen rather than demonizing the migrant and other figures of racial threat. Finally, I want to point out that there are meaningful symmetries between the affective dimensions of precaritization in the mode of desperate responsibility and the affective impulses of Trumpian citizenship. Precarity helps shape the Trumpist worker citizen, in other words, not only in patterns of consciousness and susceptibility to strategies of discursive representation, but also in terms of becoming accustomed to a distinctive societal structure of feeling. Critical theorists Leah Harrow and Roman Coles provide an insightful critique of Trumpian affect politics that is particularly useful for my purposes because of their accent on popular experiences of time. They write that Trump's affective repertoire includes, first of all, a hyper-intensification of shock politics. Such politics are characterized by, quote, the disjointed, unpredictable tempos of Twitter-like communications and unvetted executive actions. And yet these ruptural events also occur incessantly, and the paradoxically ongoing character of crisis distracts, disorients, and disorganizes the polity in ways that work to overload the circuits of critical response. Amplifying shock political governance, they write, and intensifying its temporal effects is a, quote, distinctive and extreme form of sovereignty that employs a sheer chaos of unpredictable and unaccountable disruptions and contradictions. For Harrow and Coles, this nominalist sovereignty, quote, admits of no otherness to which it is accountable, not even the leader himself in eye blink prior to the present. And for ordinary citizens, this sense of living under arbitrary rule becomes all the more acute, all the more palpable through their immersion in a psychophysical environment that emits, quote, ubiquitous and unanswerable violence from all quarters. Think of the gun violence in America. Harrow and Coles write, just as Trump shocks come anytime and all the time, these expressions of resonant violence can emerge explosively from anywhere and everywhere. Conceiving of precarity as desperate responsibility helps explain why this political affective formation wins popular support. For legions of precaritized working people, right-wing populism makes sense not only because of what it says, but also because it feels familiar. The temporal flows and fractures in the Trumpist sensorium exhibit the same clash between oppressive continuity and bewildering discontinuity to which most workers already are acclimated through the precaritized conditions of laboring life. right-wing populism thrives not just through the discursive transposition of racial signifiers to new reference, but also through the affective transposition of precarious work temporalities into the embodied experience of citizenship in the Trumpian polity. In addition, for both the precaritized worker and the Trumpian citizen, acting responsibly is both impossible and compulsory. Under conditions that make work not just stressful, but desperate and dangerous, precaritized laborers lack the autonomy to make responsible choices, even as they are tasked with doing so. And citizens, similarly, are told by the nominal sovereign to revive the republic, but deprived of the basis for doing so in democratically responsible ways. In the affective zone, co-constituted by Trumpian shock politics and resonant violence, and precarity as desperate responsibility, prospects for settling into the zone of hopeful stillness needed to gain and use political literacy become ever more remote, as does the time for reflection needed to excavate parallel fates and migrantize the citizen. So to conclude, for all the justified relief that many are feeling right now, including myself, about Trump's departure and the Democrats' return to the White House, a more difficult and longer-term political project lies before us. And this is to build an alternative politics of precarity that has two key strengths. First, the capacity to incubate temporally unconventional conjunctions of working and political activity, thereby offering lived, practical alternatives to the temporalities of desperate responsibility and the affective milieu of Trumpian citizenship. And second, such a politics must foment the ability to contest dynamics of precarity that envelop vast majorities of working people in common conundrums of antinomial time and moral frustration, even while fighting extreme precaritization on society's margins. My research identifies promising tendencies of these kinds in the worker centers organized by day laborers, which I'd be glad to talk about during the Q&A if anyone would like. But I'll stop there and welcome any questions that anyone has.
Thank you very much, Paul. That was fascinating. I'm sure there will be questions. So if people would like to raise their hands and then get the opportunity to ask Paul directly. So we have Evelina, who would like to ask a question.
Thank you, Lucinda, and thank you, Paul, for the very engaging presentation. It reminds me of a book by Ben Judah called This is London, and in it, he talks about Eastern European day laborers in East London, who back then in 2016, when the book was published, were legal. So there's a difference compared to the sample of people you studied, that some of them might also be illegal on top of it. With respect to their precarity, things might have gotten worse for them because with Brexit, they're quite hard to engage with respect to their legal status, settled status in the UK. So they are most likely moving into a more precarious position than before. And then looking forward, I was thinking you mentioned that the day laborer centers might offer, from what I understand, ways ahead to protect the rights of people in such position, or maybe to enhance their political engagement. And I know in the US there have been Hispanic organizations over the last few decades that have been protecting illegal migrants and their rights. So I was wondering what your advice will be and what the takeaway points are from the role these centers can play, and how can this be translated into the UK situation? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Evelina, and for the book recommendation, which I'll check out. I'm fairly recently arrived still in the UK, got here about 18 months ago after an earlier career in the United States. And so I'm very curious to learn more about what kinds of parallel organizations to American Latino worker centers might exist over here, including in Latin American communities of migrants in London, perhaps. But I don't know much about that yet. I think that the worker centers like Casa Latina and the MLK Center in the Northwest of the US, where I did my research, show promise for developing the forms of anti-precarity politics that I discussed, or at least alluded to towards the end of my talk, for a couple of reasons. So, but first I'll say that that opinion among the workers is hardly unanimous about what it means to be a member of these organizations. And in some ways, I think this reflects the kind of the very extensive and, you know, diverse channels of power through which right-wing populist appeals can function, even people who are in this marginalized position and who are subject to as much constant racism and poverty as these workers are, can sometimes sound very authoritarian in their political attitudes towards the center when they emphasize the need for there to be strict rules and to distinguish insiders from outsiders by virtue of who seems to be a hardworking individual committed to the job and who's, you know, a good for nothing criminal. And they don't have any time for the democratic processes of the centers. It's not a majority of people at Casa Latina and BOS, but it's a substantial minority. What I see that's of greater promise, however, is a culture that converts the sort of conditions of precarity into the basis of a sort of intellectually rich political solidarity. So it starts really with what workers call a culture of conviviality, that's their word, convivencia, to describe the ways that they just sort of share time with each other on an everyday basis and also share whatever material resources they have, like bus tickets, or if someone has a little money and someone else has none, or a little food, or tips about abusive employers. There is this kind of culture of mutualism and mutual support that grows up in the center that then also generates political forms of cooperation in, first of all, running the center for themselves as an autonomous collective, but then also advocating for migrants in the society more broadly. So worker centers are among those Evelina, you know, organizations that you alluded to in the Latino and Hispanic communities that have been supporting migrant rights, sometimes through civil disobedience, like solidarity, sanctuary movements in the US. So I think this is where, and it comes back to time, because what I see these organizations doing that's so ingenious is they sort of reoccupy the fragmented time and the anxious time of everyday work life, and they break it up and give workers the palpable experience of different ways of, and workers will say, more free ways of spending their time teaching one another. People who came to our classes didn't just learn English, they stuck around afterwards and swapped words in their, you know, some indigenous languages and some in Spanish. So there was kind of a sort of reorientation. The concern with economic necessity never really left. So it wasn't like community versus economy. It was taking that substrate of economic need and desperation, but not letting that define the collective's political consciousness. That's what I see that's so promising there.
Thank you. That was a great response. I think it was the question as well, was it where that you begged at the answer at the end of your presentation. So it's really good to hear those thoughts. Who else would like to ask a question? We have Andrea Soga here.
Hi, Paul. Thanks very much for your talk. I thought it was really interesting. And as a political theorist, it's also a great example of how you can sort of combine fieldwork research with sort of these very abstract concepts of political theory more generally. So I thought that was really interesting. My question very briefly is simply, what struck me about your talk and specifically the link that you made between the politics of precarity and the rise of Trumpist populism. What struck me when I was watching the election coverage this year was how many people from all racial and a variety of racial and ethnic groups kind of said they voted for Trump out of a fear of what they perceived as socialism and socialist policies coming from Biden. Mm-hmm. And I wondered whether there was a link that one could make between the politics of precarity as desperate responsibility and this particularly strong personal responsibility dimension and this fear of socialism as kind of, and I wondered whether there was a link that could be made there to kind of explain this dimension of support for Trump.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, Andreas. I think so, and I'm trying to understand better the growth in Latino support for Trump over the last 4 years, because it's been a secular phenomenon. It's not just with this election, although this election manifests it more clearly. But evidently, for some people, and this is just, you know, from a scattered look at the journalist accounts, but for some people who are migrants, they hear socialism and identify that with a political system they have left behind in Mexico, where, you know, there was one party dominance for so many years, and where socialism for some who come to the US has that kind of negative connotation. I think insofar as socialism implies responsibility, you know, social forms of responsibility and responsibility for that's political, that is not just for you, but for a community, then the formation of desperate responsibility is a trap, because it focuses those energies, you know, those desires on individual achievement and individual self-protection. Protection is another key theme that comes out among the workers who are least inclined to endorse a more community-minded, a more solidaristic conception of what membership in the worker center is all about. And so I think you're right. We didn't hear the workers in these interviews talk about political ideologies on a large level, like socialism, except in a couple of cases. Or capitalism. There was one former graduate student, though, who was a day laborer and who knew an awful lot about political theory. But I think what you're suggesting is basically on track. And I think in the more popular language, it's a matter of just feeling personal responsibility, but then stopping there rather than connecting personal responsibility to responsibility for the whole. And I want to underscore that I think that is what worker centers are doing that is so creative and so promising. It's not counterposing altruism or responsibility for others to quote unquote selfish or self-directed desires. It's giving people concrete context for seeing how their own security, advancement, well-being is tied up with that of the community.
Yes, interesting question. So I'd like to ask one, if I may. I was interested in the question of gender, or the sort of the absence of the question of gender, perhaps in your talk. So you moved from the talking about the day laborers, who, as you pointed out, were I think 95% men. Then thinking more generally as a precarity across society more widely, but we also and then with the Trumpism, we know that women were less likely to vote for Trump. So I just wondered whether you had any comment on that, whether it was whether your model actually fits so well for women, particularly given these sort of this non-standard work lives have been talked about and being sort of generally historically more common for women anyway. Mm-hmm. So just any observations or comments you have on that, I'd appreciate.
Yeah, I mean, it actually gets to, so the book does discuss gender in ways that I just didn't talk about in this talk. And it talks about how the themes, as they're articulated by these workers, have distinctly masculine connotations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at the time when we did the interviews, Casa Latina in Seattle was just starting a rather fledgling program for women who would get house cleaning jobs through there. And there were literally only about 6 or 7 women. You saw the photo in my slides there of the parking lot, where the men were all standing there waiting for their names to be called out. And then around the edges on some days, there were like 5 or 6 women. And it was really, really, really difficult. And there was actually a movement by some of the men to kick them out of the center and say, this is just for men. And the Portland place still has only has men as members. But, you know, the women's movement at Casa Latina has now grown into a, you know, movement on equal standing. In fact, today they're slightly more politically active than the men are. But I think, if I were going back and doing the study now, there'd be no question that it would involve men and women at Casa Latina, but it was basically a men's organization when we did the interviews. So what I would say is, The sort of analytical crux of my analysis has to do with this designation of day labor as both exception and synecdoche with respect to precarity on society's level as a whole. And I think that the themes that these workers formulate, on the one hand, do give expression to exceptional or particular experiences that characterize these people who are Latinos, mostly, not entirely, but almost entirely Latinos, and who are almost entirely men in this particular place. And I'm saying that I think the resonances with experiences of precarity on a broader, much broader social level are real, and that it's worth engaging in this thought experiment or exercise, if you will, of mapping those resonances and those mapping those parallels as an instigation to further research. I mean, I think this is why the idea of the generative theme is so generative, I would say, because, you know, different groups of precaritized workers are going to come up with different language to describe the conditions that they face. And even if they use the same words, it'll mean different things. But if you think, but this is, I think, the promise of popular education in the Freirean mode too, is that it's supposed to bring that, put that language into circulation within the dialogues that happen among people. So the people who are coming from different social positions then can sort out, you know, what term works for me, or how does that term work for me then in a way that it doesn't work for you, but still being oriented not just to the identification of difference, but also to the formation of solidarity. So I think that's, I just want to say that as a note of caution about when I'm saying a part that represents the whole. That's, you know, I use this term from literary theory, synecdoche, quite self-consciously. It's, you know, a sort of experiment in representation that should call forth other competing representations. It's not meant to be a sort of finalistic account of what precarity is. Because that,
I suppose I was just thinking the extent to which that whole is a whole in is a masculine whole, or whether it's a whole for men and women. Maybe we can talk about that further sometime.
I did want to say one more thing. You know, I had this idea that I'm taking from Antonio Vasquez Arroyo about political literacy, mm-hmm. and this idea of seeing moments of loss, not simply as losses, but also as political defeats. I saw that really vividly at Casa Latina right after Trump was elected in 2016. It was really interesting because I was at a community meeting where a lot of very scared families from the migrant community in Seattle had come to come up with a plan for how they were going to sort of deal with what they expected would be intensified pressure from the immigration authorities in their neighborhoods, in their places of employment, in their churches, what have you. And it seemed as though kind of all of white liberal Seattle was in shock and felt like the world had suddenly collapsed and the sky had fallen. And I just was really struck by the different tone of things at the meeting in Casa Latina, which was not that the sky had fallen, this was bad, but what the organizer said was, we have been fighting the homeland security state for decades now, and it's been getting a lot worse in recent years. This is bad, this is worse than it's been. But it was that kind of historical consciousness that this is a defeat in a longer term struggle. We need to analyze why this defeat happened and fight it. I think in that respect too, in terms of training people in political literacy, that's necessary for democracy. That's where these worker centers show promise.
No, I think that's a really interesting example, but yeah. I'm going to have to stop you there, I'm afraid. I'm going to thank you very much for a fascinating talk, and look forward to the what's coming out of your future work, as well as the book, of course. I'd like to draw people's attention to some forthcoming events just before I go. So at the III tomorrow, there'll be an event at 5 p.m. called Classes of Labour, Work and Life in a Central Indian Steel Town with Speaker Jonathan Parry. And he's from the Department of Anthropology. And there's a link in the chat if you're interested in following that up. For this series, the Migration, Ethnicity and Race Seminar Series, the next talk will be on the 24th of November when Professor Cindy Chung from Cardiff we'll be talking about the violence of uncertainty, how asylum waiting time undermines refugees' health. And so I look forward to seeing some of you there. And if you want any more information about upcoming events, you can sign up to the II newsletter. And again, there's a link in the chat. So it just remains to thank you again, Paul, very much for a fascinating talk. Goodbye.
Bye. Thank you, Lucinda. Thanks, everyone.